as you would think, with the proper installation of a vertical with enough radials and all that, you would be able to a single band antenna even. And even if the soil is the crummiest soil, I think that all these radials would, you know, take care of the situation. I just have got no answers for these. And these questions stick over.
Okay, don't give up.
Yeah, when you have a dipole in free space, and it's going to be a little bit of a repeat, but a dipole in free space, you're allowed to put a sheet of metal down the middle of it at right angles, normal to the dipole itself, because the right-hand side at one instant of time is positive, the left-hand side is negative. There's a neutral plane down the center. You can put a sheet of metal there, an infinite sheet of metal. And once you do that, you can decide, I'm going to feed the right-hand side, reference the sheet of metal, and now you've got a vertical ground plane antenna. And by the mirror image in the sheet of metal, you're reproducing the other half of the dipole. So when you have a zillion radials laid down on perfect conducting soil, on a ground plane antenna, what you really got is a vertical dipole where half of it's below ground and half of it's above ground. You've got a dipole that is mounted very close to the Earth's surface. And when you compare that to a horizontal dipole or a vertical dipole that's mounted in the air at 30 feet, we'll say, or 40 or 50 feet, that extra altitude is going to give you a lot of performance. And so the fact that the perfect ground plane antenna on the Earth at a low altitude doesn't outperform a ratty old $4 worth of hardware dipole at 40 feet, when you look at the big picture, it's a little bit more predictable. Look at the altitude of the antenna. You want your antenna to work well, particularly a VHF antenna. You know the three things required, altitude, and altitude. In the case of an HF antenna, because the ionosphere is so heavily involved, altitude is a little bit less critical, but boy, it still helps. Give me altitude over gold-plated performance claims of a very fancy-looking antenna. When in doubt, give me altitude. You got it, Mel.
2MB.
Yes, I need helium.
Here I go. Let's see what Barry's got to say. Barry, have you been doing some of these comparisons, and are you getting a similar horror story? K2 moonbound. N2 moonbound. K2RIW.
Hey, K2RIW, N2 moonbound for meatball or something. Yeah, actually, I'm not trying to change the subject here. This, what I'm about to inject here, has a lot to do with height. Because I think I once discussed this briefly with you before. There's a fellow in New Jersey who has making an antenna small to its extreme. And he claims it's not very lossy, that it actually performs pretty close to a dipole. He has a 75-meter model. It's called TAKTENNA, TAK-TENNA. You ought to look that one up. And his 75-meter version is only $45. And it weighs like, I don't know, 5 pounds or something. It easily can be put high up on a very small pole. He recommends trying to rotate it because it says when you rotate it, you get the effect of rotating a dipole. And it's really small. You ought to look at this one.
Okay, I'm trying to find the website on it right now. So give us a couple of words on it, Barry. And if I haven't found it in time, I'll pass it back to Mel.
Okay, the best way to do it, because his real website is so long and confusing. I have it in here right now as http://www.tak-tenna.com. .tak-tenna.com. And that sort of brought it up. I hope you found it. One of the advantages of it, he's following most of the rules about, you know, not having any connections near current points and, you know, all the things you'd want to do if you made an antenna small. And you have said repeatedly, the size of the antenna really doesn't matter if it's really efficient. If you did your job well, it could be very, very small and perform darn close to the big model of it. This is on he says it's on a 30-inch boom. It's really not a boom. It's a spreader. I think boom is a misnomer here. When you think boom, you're thinking he has separate elements on it or something. It's not like that, but take a look. And by the way, the other thing is, he says it easily handles 1,400 watts or something. I mean, you know, because he did his homework, this thing is working quite well.
Yeah, I'm on the website right now for Tactena. I've got that beautiful color photograph. I would call that a boom. He's got a forward element and a reverse element. Each one of them is a spiral, a metallic spiral, suspended on that crisscross design. On the back one I could call the reflector, the forward one I could call the director if I wanted to. What'd you say, Barry?
You can't call it a reflector and a director. Those are just two halves of a dipole, all twisted up, so they're not really directors. In other words, that thing is not transmitting end fire. That thing is transmitting broadside like a dipole.
I'm going to accept that. So he's got these very elaborate top hat spiral structures on the ends of what is a rotatable dipole, and so he's got a kind of an infinitesimal antenna, and because he's made it out of low-loss materials, there's no resistors there anywhere, I can see how he puts a kilowatt into it, and he's going to radiate a kilowatt into space, and he's going to radiate it in a quasi-dipole-like manner. He's going to have a little bit of circular polarization because of that spiral, which is not bad. That's not a bad-looking antenna. That can save you a lot of real estate, and the fact that it's rotatable, at times you can have a lot of fun with that.
Well, also, it's really easy to put the antenna very high.
Exactly. Do you know any personal testimonials of people who have actually owned or used one of those, Barry?
I don't know the guy personally, but hold on a second, and I will find you a testimonial. It's called the Tactena here it is. Boy, is that a long one. www.hamuniverse.com/tactenareview.html without a dash in there. You can remember all that.
Okay, so you've read one of those testimonials, and does it seem to be a substantial person saying that I've used it, I love it, and I'm telling all my friends about it. Is that essentially what you're reading, Barry?
Yeah, it's exactly what I'm reading. The guy said he thought the performance was infinitely better than he ever would have expected. He tried it out against a dipole. He tried it out against, you know, some of these expensive verticals. He said it outperformed the expensive verticals easily. And it was so close to the dipole that he's having trouble noticing the difference. That's pretty impressive.
And I see the bottom of this ad says the price is only $48. And is that for a, what band is that, $48 one on, Barry?
I'm led to believe that's the 75 meter version. He has made them for 40 and 20. When you get below 20 meters, I don't think you need this thing, but he has made it for 15 meters and several other bands.
A fully rotatable 80-meter or 75-meter antenna for $48 with your ham-em or whatever rotator. That's not a bad antenna. I think that guy's got something. Mel, have you seen this ad? I think this guy's got something. K2KEY, KQRIW in the group.
Okay, I guess we'll hear from this people now. what is he called? Let me write this down, and I will take a look at it in a little while. What this guy is selling, because I'm telling you, they're coming in one after another here, you know, and about the claims on these verticals and all. And what website is it, Vic? Over.
You're going to write down www.tak-tenna.com. Tactena.com. And he's got a nice color photograph of this $48 fully rotatable 75 meter antenna. Looks nice and compact. I'm seeing it alongside of what I think is either a ham-end or an AR-22 rotator. And boy, it ain't that big compared to that rotator. It looks to me like a 20 pounds, 30 pounds of antenna. And I think this guy's got something, because the infinitesimal dipole is capable of very high performance when compared to a full-out dipole. He has solved the problem of impedance matching. He solved the problem of bringing it down to a small size. He's claiming he solved the problem of getting reasonable bandwidth out of it. So it ain't heavy, it ain't high in wind load, it's reasonable in bandwidth, and it's reasonable in performance, and it's darn nice and bright. Other than that, I like it.
I'd like to put two of them on a 30-foot boom and phase them as a beam. That would be interesting.
Now you're talking. That on 75 with your rotatable boom compared to a couple of stepper IRs on the other band, and boy, you got a rock crusher combination. Now back to you, Mel.
WP2HWW at a comment, please.
Okay.
Give me 1 second, Howie. Yeah, I was just going to mention, I have mentioned this many a time that I'm really amazed, you know, again, that I am using that receiving unit. Now, I've never transmitted with the DIC. I don't know, I'm reluctant to transmit with anything that's, you know, within a foot of my body, literally even down on HF, down on 75 meters. But if I have that vertical loop and I turn that vertical loop to peak it, in many cases, in fact, I will say it's at least equal or better in distance, if I use, like I say, just the criteria of receiving, then I'm comparing it to a full wave loop at 45 feet. That's 272 feet of wire strung around four supports that are 45 feet up. Here I'm using a loop that is less than 0.1 wavelength, so it don't surprise me. I'm always curious in my mind. I know I like to get through it one of these days. Take that vertical loop I have, that receiving loop, get it outside up in the air, and put power in. You know, where even at 100 watts, I think the way it is right now, that I'm sure I noticed some very high voltage developed at the tuning capacitor, but I think the one I got on there right now, it's a broadcast type tuning capacitor. Maybe I could put a little larger, you know, higher voltage one on there, maybe, and give it a try. But I would be curious, with a loop at 0.1, less than 0.1 wavelength, how would it perform in comparison to a full wavelength loop, Dick? This I have not, you know, like I say, pursued past the receiving point. Over.
Yeah, Howie, I'm going to get to you next. I've got a suggestion for you, Mel. And when in doubt, make an error on the conservative side. And very intelligently, you're doing that. In other words, to take a small 0.1 wavelength diameter loop that's in the shack with you 1 or 2 or 3 feet away, and to put a kilowatt into it, without first making a measurement or a darn good calculation that's somehow traceable to the bureau, that would be a little bit risky. I mean, you and I have spent 67 years getting where we are. We don't want to throw it all away. So we're both born in 1940 in February. That's why we kid each other back and forth about this. There's a simple solution, Mel. Take a piece of coax cable, strip away the center conductor, loop that center conductor with its insulation on it, back on itself to a known diameter. I don't care if it's a 1-inch diameter, 3-inch diameter, 6-inch diameter, a known diameter is where it has a known amount of cross-sectional area of the loop. That connected to a fast oscilloscope, a power meter, a spectrum analyzer, whatever. If you've got a fast enough oscilloscope that'll respond to 3.5 megacycles, so that's where you're operating the thing. And very good scopes these days will do that. And the scope itself has got a built-in calibrator. See, you can measure volts per meter. You can calibrate that loop by knowing its area. You know exactly how much H field it picks up. And therefore, you can slowly sneak up on your loop, put 1 watt into it, 10 watts into it, 100 watts into it, and watch that signal with your little sensing loop in your oscilloscope or whatever. Position it every way from 6 ways from Sunday that you can in the shack. And I think there's a 98% chance you're going to find out that at least at the 100-watt level, if not the 500-watt level, your antenna is safe. And once you prove by real measurement that it's safe, then go ahead and conservatively start doing some transmitting experiments. And I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised, because The fact that you can position that loop in your shack in azimuth and elevation, you can twist it and turn it and whatever, you can favor the best signal-to-noise ratio for that particular day, whether you're transmitting or receiving. I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised. Howie, WB2HWW, go right ahead with your question or comment.
It's a common thing. I've been in this ham radio since 1967. All I can tell you is that $5 to $10 worth of parts would outbeat these really expensive antennas for the average ham. You know where these verticals cost money? When you're putting up a 10-meter repeater vertical and you want a DC ground and you want to blast, that's when you start spending $400 and $500. But if you make a dipole, inverted V, sloping dipole, I've had more fun and better results than going out and spending hundreds of dollars and buying all these crazy end verticals or short antennas. A few dollars in parts, and you've got the best antenna in the world, Dick.
Oh, I believe with you. That's the reason why whenever you study, whenever you use any of these study guides, and they show you a beginner's antenna, boy, a Hertzian dipole, because Heinrich Hertz invented it way back in 1887 or whatever the hell it was. Boy, it is hard to beat the bang per dollar, dollar per bang, you know what I'm trying to say, performance per dollar of that antenna. When in doubt, put up one of those and start comparing everything else to it. And so, because it's so easy, so cheap, and you can easily get it up to altitude with bow and arrow, slingshot, whatever, it's got a lot going for it. So don't sell it short just because it looks so cheap and simple. And I've seen some awful nice dipole installations at field day sites. I think, Mel, when it comes back to you, you're going to tell us that some changes have been made at the, I can't think of the name of it now, it's not the Johnson Center, but you know what I mean, at Floyd Bennett Field, the Mitchell, I think it's called the Mitchell Center. I think there's some, the big room where you guys normally were living in the lap of luxury, I think they've made that into a museum, and you're now going to be displaced to some other place for this particular field day. But still, if I know you guys, you're going to have a pretty nice operation, and I'm going to try to make an attempt to drop in on you. K2KEY in the group, K2RIW.
Next tonight at 8 o'clock.
Okay, yeah, no, we'll be in the same building. We just crossed the hall, you know, not far, about maybe about 100 feet, 75 feet away from the room that we're in, so you won't have no problem finding us. Just instead of when you come in, normally you either turn left, turn right, that's all. you'll see anyhow. We'll have signs and everything. But we expect that, you know, quite a number of people to drop in now that the you know, that Floyd Bennett has been really coming more or less into its own now. We've got the Concorde sitting there, which is quite an attraction. They built a sports center there. They have a number of other attractions that bit by bit are coming in there. So I would assume that we should have maybe a number of people that will stop in to see what amateur radio is like. So all is welcome. Again, very easy to get deployed. Dennis, and of course, like I say, free parking. Oh, plenty, plenty of parking. Park cars. Thousands without any problem. Big, big area. Again, sticking with the antennas before we get off, you know, this whole business. In all the years, like you say, when antennas have been around, how come then we're still seeing, you know, half-wave dipoles for 75 meters, 80 meters that are, you know, full wavelength, long, and all that stuff? If there, I mean, is this a new science that all of a sudden we said, you don't need all these big antennas, these long wires, and all this stuff? You can do it with a little compact thing, I could say, to weigh 5 pounds. I mean, this loop that I'm using, that I could say, 0.1 wavelength, a little less than 0.1 wavelength. I will eventually, now the weather will get warm, I'll have a chance. What I'll do one night, easily, I'll take it out of my patio deck, which is up on the second floor. I have a patio deck that's on the second floor, and I have a place there where I can actually raise it up. I will set it up for a comparison test with my friends that I get on 75 meters, you know, around 11:30 at night. That Barry, of course, many times is one of our joiners, and Paul. And I'll get some reports, and I want to see if I turn this loop towards any of them and take it, what is the comparison? Very, very easy for me to walk out the door and walk back into the shack. I'll run it at a reason. I'll get a night that's really hard to find, night about 75, where the noise level isn't ferocious. But I'd like to just get, you know, a report. Are you going to say to me that, oh my God, that I will most likely find that my one wavelength loop and my point one wavelength loop are going to perform equally? I'm going to be very flabbergasted, because if that be the case, again, as Barry said, why don't we make, we can make beams. The whole thing is only 12 feet in circumference, 3 feet on a side. I could easily make up some kind of beam or something like that, and I'm sure that with that kind of size, you could make up easily a multi-element beam stick. How come I have never seen anything like this? In fact, most people, I mentioned to them about, you know, this type of loop I'm using, this receiving loop, this 0.1 wavelength, and they, you know, hardly even heard of it. You know, they've heard of some of these loops that are manufactured and sold as these isopoles and all these isoloops or whatever they call them, and they never really took off. They never seen anything, you know, spectacular with the stick over.
And part of what's going on here is that part of it is attitude, part of it is science. You take a guy who's just graduated from college, as I've done recently. We hired a man who was near summa cum laude from Purdue, very good college in Indiana. And he's working with me. And when he first arrived, I asked him, hey, I'm going to call him John. That's not his name. Hey, John, how many kinds of antennas are there? And he says, I guess there's about 8 or 10. And I said, well, depending on how you rate the difference of antennas, I think there's 5,000 kinds of antennas. Now, you could do a real thorough study, and you'll say some of those differences are really kind of minor, and maybe you really think there's 3,325. That's a lot of antennas. That's one attitude. Second of all, Mr. Hertzian, Heinrich Hertz, way back in something like 1887, I don't know the exact year, invented something like a dipole. So here we are 120 years later, 130 years later, and you would think we know everything there is to know about a dipole. Well, you crack open the December issue, 2006, of the IEEE journal called Antennas and Propagation. And in there, you'll find a guy who has found a way of making a dipole, which normally is a 3% bandwidth antenna, 3%, and he's made it work over an octave, 100% bandwidth. And he did it by making it look like a Yagi, but it's not a Yagi. He's got an element in front of the dipole, he's got an element behind the dipole, and this is a 1 gigahertz printed circuit dipole. That's where he did the experiment, 1 gig. And there's nothing stopping you and I from doing it at some other frequency. At 1 gig, he builds this very wide piece of strip line as it, what looks like a director and looks like a reflector on both sides of this printed circuit wide copper dipole. Except that the director and the reflector are very identical in size. So this thing has no directivity. And he proved by making measurements it's got the exact same pattern of a real ordinary dipole. But it's 100% wide instead of 3% wide when you properly stack these two parasitic-like elements. So here's a guy, 130 years later, making an improvement on a dipole. I filed a patent, and it was granted for a Yagi antenna. Mr. Hindusugi Yagi wrote his article in 1928. And here I am, 75, 80 years later, making a modification of a three-element Yagi and filing for a patent that got granted. So, the world of antennas, there's a lot more going on than first meets the eye. You think that, I mean, it's very similar to one of the presidents way back in 1910 saying this automobile is so beautiful, we've done everything we can do. We've reached the end of the line in the design of automobiles. Well, you think so? take a look at a modern day automobile with a real good anti-lock braking system, a cruise control, air conditioning, all kinds of computers connected to the engines that are getting much higher miles per gallon, much lower undesired emissions, and fancy transmissions that switch between first, second, and third gear so quietly and smoothly that you don't even know that the darn thing has shifted. And the whole thing is so soundproof and so quiet and so comfortable. Wow. And you and I could sit here and say, man, that is the end of the line of the development of automobiles. You say that statement, and I guarantee a couple of years from now, somebody's going to laugh at you and me some fears. There's no end to this jazz. So the simple little dipole antenna ain't that simple. When you're into science and physics, if you think whatever you're studying is simple, you probably don't understand the problem. There's a lot more than first meets the eye. You and I have had the discussion where, and I've had this discussion with a number of my so-called very smart friends. What the hell happened during Apollo 15? The astronauts of Apollo 15 are sitting on the moon, two of them are on the moon, one of them is in orbit, and I set up this antenna in Farmingdale, and I listened to the 2-gig signal. 2287.5 megahertz is the downlink frequency of the Apollo command module. I'm sitting there and listening to it. Not one single electron left that antenna on the moon. That hard vacuum between the moon and the Earth, there wasn't a single molecule of anything there for all practical purposes. Nothing was there before they turned on the transmitter. When they turned on the transmitter, nothing was there. And when they were through talking and turned off the transmitter, nothing was there. Not one single electron left that moon and came to the Earth. We say a wave traveled. We say photons moved. These are great words. What the hell happened? I mean, after all my years of experience, you tell me the gain of the transmitting antenna, you tell me any watts it's got, you tell me the gain of the area of the receiving antenna, you tell me the noise figure, you tell me the bandwidth of the receiver, and with high accuracy to the nearest tenth of a dB, I can tell you how strong the signal's going to be and how strong the signal-to-noise ratio is going to be, and I can predict for you what the audio is going to sound like. I've got that degree of predictability because of past experience. So quantitatively, I can tell you what you're going to observe. But down at the nitty-gritty level, I don't know what the hell happened. There's more to it than first meets the eye. KQKBY. Maybe we'll figure it out someday, Mel. KQRIW.
Ma'am, this is KQKBY. I can say, you know, it's truly amazing when you think about these things. That what are you doing when, you know, you're sending a device with a little transmitter and... I think that that Voyager, where it's out, I have no idea. Is it true that they have been able to turn it on occasionally, even at its vast distance, Dick, turn on that little transmitter and still be able to, under the right circumstances, of course, with the phenomenal, you know, piece of equipment for receiving, but how far out is that? Is that, I believe it's the furthest thing that we've ever so far had two-way communications with. Am I correct? Over.
Absolutely. I think it's Voyager, but anyhow, that particular spacecraft has gone considerably beyond the orbit of Pluto. Pluto, on average, is 39 astronomical units away from the Sun. One astronomical unit is the distance between, the average distance between Earth and Sun, 93 million miles. Multiply that by 39, and you have the average distance to Pluto. And that Voyager spacecraft is considerably beyond Pluto. It is outside of either the old or the new definition of the solar system. It's out there running its 10-watt traveling wave tube transmitter, and at a very small number of bits per second, communicating back to the Goldstone 240-foot dish, saying, here I am, and this is what I've measured 20 years or whatever it is downrange from this far out. I think it takes 8 hours at the speed of light for the signal. Is it 5.5 hours? 5.5 hours to Pluto is probably 7 hours. 6.5 or 7 hours at the speed of light is how long it takes for that signal to leave that spacecraft and come down here to Earth, and we pick it up and listen to it periodically, and it tells us what its health is, what the battery voltage is, how well its thermal electric generator is doing, and it's making measurements out there of what is a solar wind like. And we're waiting until it crosses the barrier between the solar system and the rest of the galaxy, where there will be a sudden change in the amount of solar wind. We know that if you go out far enough, eventually the solar wind will stop moving, so to speak, and now you'll be looking at the galactic wind instead of solar wind. It hasn't hit that yet, and it's still giving reports. And that's the furthest piece of hardware mankind has ever created, and the darn thing is still going. And by the way, the New Horizons spacecraft, when it goes whizzing by Pluto, as it's going to in some number of years in the future, it will be moving considerably faster. It will eventually overtake the range of Voyager, and that will be the new high in distance. I ain't seen nothing yet. Hang in there. Back to you, Mel.
Oh, my question to you is, how possibly can a 10-watt transmitter do this? This is it. I can't conceive how a 10-watt transmitter is capable of this, Dick. Over.
Okay, the 10-watt transmitter is running at 8.5 gigahertz with a dish antenna. And I got to guess it for the size of the dish. They're getting around 33 dB of gain out of that antenna. So 33 dB of gain, 10 watts, that's 2,000 to 1, 2,000 times 10. It's a 20,000-watt effective isotropic radiated signal from a very well crystal-controlled transmitter, such that on the ground down here at Goldstone, if you've got the right piece of hardware with a very low-noise Acer parametric amplifier connected to the feed horn of the Goldstone dish, aimed at Voyager at the time that the alignment of the sun and everything else is such that you're not looking into the sun and getting extra noise into your antenna, and you go down to something like a 3 hertz equivalent noise bandwidth receiver. You narrow up the IF strip of the receiver so that it's about 3 hertz, and you're getting 3 bits of information per second from that satellite. As you make the bandwidth of the receiver more and more narrow, you pick up less and less noise. And as long as the signal from the transmitter is steady enough that it stays in the receiver bandwidth and is turning on and off and is sending you the equivalent of Morse code, it's sending bits of information, and it's telling you what it reports, and it has, they were smart enough to build that spacecraft that they could command it into high, medium, low, or super low data rate. And so when you're that far out and the signal is that weak, and my guess is they're picking up a signal of something like minus 145 dBm. I could calculate that for you. Anyhow, it's in that vicinity. And your signal generator doesn't come anywhere near that low. You got another 40 dB to go before you can get your signal generator down that far. The leakage from the cabinet would be a hell of a lot louder than that. But as long as you've got a very steady signal and an extremely narrow, well-tuned receiver and a very low-noise front end, on a 240-foot diameter dish, which at that frequency is giving you something like 60 or so decibels of gain, and it's giving you 2/10 of a degree of beam width, and you aim it in just the right direction, you can communicate. You've heard me say so many times, Mel, when you and I, or anyone else, within the sound of our voice, generates a radio signal, that radio signal goes to every cubic centimeter of this universe. It's going to go there. You can't stop it from doing that. The only thing left to discuss is when that signal gets there. Is it above the threshold of the receiver that you're now using? And that's a matter of how fast the data is being sent. Is the antenna aimed in the right direction? Is the noise figure low enough? Is the receiver narrow enough in bandwidth? You meet all those criteria, and what is the range of a radio signal? You can't define it. You give me a high enough gain antenna and a narrow enough receiver and a slow enough data rate, and I probably can exceed any range you can imagine. You may not be happy with the data rate. It may be too darn slow. You've got to wait around too long for the message to get through, but the message will get through. K2KUI, K2RIW.
I just want to do this one more time, Dick. This is K2KUI. Are you saying then that if we transmit it, you know, started transmitting on the UHF and all bands some years ago, TV, whatever, and are you going to tell me that this signal will go on, that they will possibly see something? I don't remember when we started transmitting on it, let's say in the 40s after World War II, when TV started coming to its own. Are you going to say to me that somewhere out there, I don't care how far, how, wherever, if it's 100 years from now, 200, 300 years, that signal will eventually, they possibly can arrive there. Is that really, it's not going to, some distance away, going to be just fade out and absolutely zero over?
There's a yes and a no to that question, Mel. Assuming now that the quality of the transmitter at the Empire State Building that was turned on in roughly 1950 was high enough in quality so that the frequency was steady enough. And if I'm out there, 1950 to now is 57 years. If I am 57 light years away with a good size antenna and a good low noise receiver, without a doubt, I will hear the carrier of that television transmitter, and it will be above threshold of my receiver. But in order to get a signal that weak, I have to use a very narrow bandwidth receiver, and the signal will only stay in that narrow bandwidth receiver if it was steady enough. Now, if there was some residual FM, there was some hum on that transmitter in 1950, and because the television receiver is 6 megacycles wide, and you could tolerate quite a bit of hum before you would see any hum bars in the picture. And because the audio is FM modulated as a subcarrier at 4.5 megs, as long as the 4.5 meg subcarrier didn't have any hum on it, I wouldn't know whether or not the main carrier had any hum. So there wasn't a super strong need for a high-quality transmitter. But assuming the transmitter was of sufficient quality in 1950, yes, gave early, 57 light years out, that signal of that carrier is now arriving, and that extraterrestrial out there has the ability to hear that carrier and say, hey, those guys are transmitting television down there. But now there's a catch. To get the whole bandwidth, the audio, the video that was being transmitted then, Howdy Doody on Channel 4 at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, that's when Howdy Doody was on, and I think almost every day of the week. Howdy Doody was on at something like 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and the Peanut Gallery, and the Princess Summer, Fall, Winter, Spring, and Mr. Bluster, and all these other characters are doing their thing. And they're doing it with video modulation of 4 megacycles of bandwidth. If you think those guys out there are going to see that video and look at the picture of Howdy Doody, I say no. Absolutely not. That's beyond physics. Because to get that video requires a 4 meg bandwidth receiver. And if they expanded the bandwidth to 4 megs, that far out, that weaker signal, they'd be getting so much noise that the picture would be unwatchable. But now, if they're really smart, and they've got what's called a rake receiver, if they've got a zillion channel of receiver that's each a tenth of a hertz wide, and so you're not only looking at the carrier, but you're looking at 1 hertz, tenth of a hertz higher, a tenth of a hertz higher, and so on. And if the quality of the transmitter was high enough that the residual FM of the transmitter was low enough that this would all work, and they put that parallel array of a zillion receivers all together, and now you're listening to each individual channel, so to speak, of that 4 megs of bandwidth, and reconstructing it, in theory, they might be able to reconstruct that picture. It's going to take a tremendous amount of digital signal processing hardware to do it, but it is within the laws of physics. Once you accept the fact that if the transmitter was high enough in quality, had low enough residual FM, and if they've got a low enough noise figure receiver with a big enough antenna and a narrow enough receiver to receive the smallest amount of noise, they will, with no doubt in my mind, find that carrier, the main carrier of the transmitter. But now, can they find the individual sidebands of the modulation? Once you accept the fact that they can extract the carrier, and now you give me a zillion channels, a tenth of a hertz wide each, to receive all the individual bits of that video, and then put it all back together again, it is within the laws of physics. Not easy. They'd have to have a lot of a priori knowledge about the nature of our television transmission before doing it, but yes, it is possible. Ain't that a mind blower? Somebody 57 years later, watching Howdy Doody, K2KEY. You're going to have trouble sleeping tonight. K2LAW.
This is K2KEY. No, I'm not, let's not talk about, like you say, the possibility of senior television broadcast. Let's talk about, for instance, that experiment. Is it true that the antenna system that they have, that one in Arecibo, Puerto Rico, that they did transmit a high-quality, very stable signal out to the far end of the universe? Is that signal still, in other words, en route to some place, Dick, over?
Absolutely. I've seen that picture, many of us have, in all the good science books. They did that not as a truly serious experiment. They did that to really set people's minds thinking about extraterrestrial intelligence. By the same token, the Drake equation, when Mr. Drake at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, way back in, I think it was around 1962, 64, somewhere around there, when they're first putting together an 85-foot dish at NRAO, he talked the contractor in putting the dish together a month and a half ahead of schedule, before it was scheduled to be used. And he used that month and a half for an extraterrestrial search. He aimed that dish at various candidate stars that he thought possibly contained life. And he listened very carefully. Didn't hear anything. But the fact that he did it, and he came up with the so-called Drake equation, which predicts what the probability of finding extraterrestrial life. And his equation was extremely conservative, because he thought stars that have solar systems around them are one in a million. Now we know that they're more frequent than 1 in 10, and maybe 1 in 2. And so he thought it was 1 in a million, and maybe it's 1 in 10. So whatever his estimation was for the amount of life up there, our recent knowledge of the exoplanets has told us that he was conservative by 100,000 to 1. His degree of prediction of the amount of life out there just became 100,000 to 1 higher. So, yes, without a doubt. That signal that they transmitted from Arecibo's 1,000-foot dish using their 10-kilowatt transmitter, and I think they did it at S-band, and they aimed it at a particular star. Did they, with their knowledge at that time, did that star really contain a solar system and contain the possibility of life? With our current knowledge, the answer is probably no. It was really sort of a mind-bending experiment. It was something to get us thinking on the subject. They did the experiment. Was it a serious attempt to really do extraterrestrial communication? That's sort of questionable. If we did it today, we'd do it much better. When we do it tomorrow, it'll be better yet. And is there life out there? I think there's almost no way that there could not be life out there. Is it easy to contact? Of course not. Have we been contacted? I don't know. That's a tough one. And even if we have been contacted by them, there's a lot of reason for them to not identify themselves, because they will be contaminating the experiment. Let's find out how these guys really work. Let's not reveal that we're here watching them. That's a possibility. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, now, let's see. Let's say, for instance, that you say that signals that, well, possibility from Howdy Doody in Channel 4 in 1950 is on its way out there. If they have the technology to put this all back together, if there is somebody or somewhere out there to put it back together, I would say possibility that they are as advanced or possibly more advanced than we are. How come then we haven't received anything? Why have we not picked up anything? If there are more than one civilization out there, if it's, let's say, possibility, like we're talking about, all of a sudden maybe there's hundreds of inhabited places out there, maybe thousands, how come nothing from all of them? I can understand if there was one place possibly out there that could have the technology, but if we think that there are to be many, 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 how come from all of it? I mean, the possibility maybe picking up one may have been very small, but if there were so many of them now, how come we have not yet honestly made a receiving contact, not transmitted back and forth? I know that's going to be possibly an impossibility for a long time if this is so bad. But why have we not received anything, Dick, so far, all these years over?
Yeah, there's two, three, four answers to this one, Mel. you hit the nail on the head when you said the distance is so great. And those words roll off the tongue very easily. When you dig into the specifics and you say that space is large and the distances are big, wow, is that an understatement? You heard my little experiment of what was it like, what was the solar system like at the instant that Spirit and Opportunity, the two beautiful spacecraft built by Steve Squires at NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory, but he's really from Cornell University, but he was on leave out there building this thing. At the instant they landed on Mars, and Mars was nearly on the other side of the sun from us, roughly 300 million miles away. If you make a scale model of that, Mars half the diameter of Earth, you use a dime for Mars, you use a 50-cent piece for the Earth, in your scale model. And if now you make the distance between the two scale, it's half a mile. So NASA took off modeling-wise from a 50-cent piece, landed on the right letter of a dime half a mile away. That's what they did with that navigating. Right. Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars is the inner portion of the solar system where the satellite, where the planets are densely packed. And the word dense is a very relative word. 50-cent piece and dime and half a mile. You call that dense packing? The outer solar system, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and used to be Pluto, that's the sparse area where the distances get multiplied by 10 to 1, bigger. 39 times the distance between us and the sun is the distance to Pluto. Our solar system, as sparse as it is in the outer planets, is very dense compared to the packing of the planets and stars between the stars. Nearest star, Proxima Centauri, 4.1 million light years away. You try to make a scale model of that, and even with a 50-cent piece of dime, I'm not sure you can fit that scale model on planet Earth. And that's just one nearby star. You probably have to go 1,000 times greater in distance in order to have a reasonable population of stars that have planets that have life. So with those distances so big, the signals get so weak, unless you've got a lot of a priori knowledge as to exactly what frequency they're transmitting on, exactly where they're located, you build this really big antenna, and you aim it just right, and you tune the receiver just right. Until you do all of that, you don't get a signal. And there's another problem. Notice what's happening with the Earth, which was predicted 20 years ago. Over-the-air broadcast, we thought that would go on forever. And along comes cable television. We used to have over-the-air broadcast. Now we have through-the-cable narrowcast. All of a sudden, everything is very well shielded so that we don't interfere with the FAA aircraft when we reuse those frequencies. And now we're going beyond that. Even the little bit of leakage you used to get from the cable. There's a couple of people who would have a leaking connector on the cable system out in front of the house. They'd set up an antenna in the house, and they would listen to the signals coming down the cable without paying for it. As long as the leaky connector was close enough, by inverse square law, you get enough signal, and you pick a big enough, build a good enough antenna inside the house, you can get the cable TV for free. Well, now, cable TV is slowly becoming passe. We're going over to fiber, where there is no leakage. So the broadcast that takes place is something that we've done for a 50-year period of time, and all of a sudden we're about to stop. There are smart people predicting that all the over-the-air television broadcasts taking place from the Empire State Building, something like 10 years from now, will not exist. Everything will be through cable, and whether that cable is coaxial cable or fiber, that's it. So over-the-air broadcast is something you do for a brief period of time, and you go on to something better. So for us to look for that extraterrestrial intelligence television broadcast, we have to listen to that little 50-year window of time when they're doing it, because when they start going over the cable TV to make the broadcast into narrowcast and make it more efficient, we ain't got a signal to watch anymore. That's the second or third answer. And beyond that, if you have the capability to visit and you really want to find out what their life is like and you don't want to contaminate the experiment, you don't reveal your presence. That's the, what was that called now? The prime directive in Star Trek. Although that's science fiction, there's a little bit of real logic to that. Back to you, Mel, K2RIW.
If you answer the question, this is K2KEY. So in other words, chances are that we're completely just are not in the, looking in the right place. I thought with all that SETI project and all that, they had more or less computerized, and they had a lot of these antennas all connected together by some intricate internet situation. A lot of people joined in on the SETI project, and yet nothing has really showed up, Dick. I thought by now that there would be something somewhere, you know, even though we know that if it was possible, we know approximately somewhere around what frequency. I mean, we're not going to look around what we were discussing on HF frequencies. I don't think we're going to look around there. I mean, we've got a fairly good idea of what frequency would be ideal for us to look at. So you mean to tell me with that SETI project, with all these antennas, all that they got, came up with that, I don't know how many people participating, but all this supposedly participation that they had, I mean, so far nothing has showed up. Is that correct, over?
Okay. When it comes to doing radio astronomy where you want to have extremely high angular accuracy, there is the very large array in Socorro, New Mexico, which is run by the NRAO, National Radio Astronomy Observatory, and that, I think, is 27 dishes spread out over something like 25 miles. Then you can take that array and combine it with similar antennas in a couple of other places on Earth, and you have a very long baseline interferometer radio telescope, and it gives you some very sharp angular resolution to make very high resolution pictures of solar systems, stars, galaxies, exploding nebula, and all this kind of jazz. There have been now by the SETI League and by the, I can't even think of the name of the organization now. I'm having trouble remembering the name of the guy. Anyhow, who I've met on a couple of occasions. There are various people doing SETI searches, private SETI searches, search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And they're trying to create an organization in which various guys will set up 1, 2, 3, 15 dishes in their backyard, and by computer networking and whatever, they reconnect themselves between a guy in Pennsylvania, a guy in California, and a guy in Spain, and so on. They're trying to do that. And now, what frequency do you choose? How accurate are the oscillators? How low, good is the noise figure? Are the dishes all aimed in the right direction? There's a lot of complications doing that right. Project Cyclops was an attempt by the NRAO people doing a study program 25 or so years ago to try to build an extremely large array of dishes to do this as a SETI search combination radio telescope. It's difficult. Right now, we're doing the first cousin to that. All your major optical astronomy observatories, and the biggest one I know of is the European Southern Observatory in Las Palmas, Chile. You've also got the one run by a consortium from at the top of the mountain in Hawaii. I can't think of the name of the mountain right now. And you've got a couple of other places in the world that are doing this. And they're looking for the fine line wobble of individual suns, individual stars. In other words, each star that's got plasma in its surface because it's running super hot is putting out very specific lines of emission. You've got a line for hydrogen, a line for oxygen, a line for iron, and so on. And you have harmonics of those lines. You look at those lines coming out of a star, and you study that very carefully for a couple of year period of time, and you see those lines wobbling back and forth across the spectrum. And if you study that wobble, you figure out how many planets are going around that star, because as the planets go around, they're tugging on the star, and they're making the star wobble back and forth. You do a careful study, a computer study of that wobble, and you find out how many planets of what size and what location are going around that star. And now you start to search, okay, we've already found 165 planets going around something like 140 stars. That's approximately the current state of the art. And now you start studying how many of them live in the Goldilocks areas, not too close to the sun where it's too hot, not too far away where it's too cold, right in the right area just like our Earth is, in this particular solar system. How many of those Goldilocks planets are what they're now starting to search for? And once you start finding the Goldilocks planets, you then start saying, okay, how old is that star? How long has that planet been in that area? If life had formed at the rate that it formed on this planet, roughly how far is the technological progress of that life? And are they about to start transmitting their version of Howdy Doody, and should we be listening to it? That's some of what's coming. Well, there's a lot of steps between here and there, though, Mel. KQKUI, KQRIW.
No, guess it's going to be an insurmountable project for quite a while. Maybe someday, but I can see that we expected, I think, a little too much, you know, too soon. We both made contact for sure any time now. All right, very good. All right, like I said, I got to catch up with the other emails here, bit by bit. Pretty recommend a number of them to pass TechNet that you've done, you know, with similar subjects that we've discussed. So it's hard to pick through them, so, but be patient, everybody out there that does send me an email. One way or the other, we'll either bring it up here on the TechNet, or I'll try to give you some idea where to go, you know, to get the answer to the problem. All right, unless you have something else, Dick, this is K2KEY.
Why don't you give us one more of your emails? We're on a roll tonight, Mel.
Let's see. Okay. There was somebody here. Yeah. Let me see. If I can find it now. Let's see. I'm trying to find one. You know, that would be within reason at this point. But I have to read them over, really. Picked up, let's see here, I'm sorry, I was sort of external automatic antenna tuners, are they worth the purchase price of a considerable price and all, and, you know, a couple of people have very high technical questions about, you know, what they're capable of and all, and would you be better off with a number from that, would they be better off using a regular tuner in the shack rather than the remote tuners. I seem to have gotten a number of those questions, Dick, over.
Yeah. If this is the best of all worlds, our feed lines will be high enough in quality, large enough in diameter, but they end up low enough in loss. If your feed line is low enough in loss, you really don't care what is the standing wave ratio of the antenna. A reasonably quality an antenna tuner in the shack of reasonable quality will crank the VisWire back down as far as the transmitter is concerned. Solid-state transmitter without any output tuning these days will only tolerate 1.5 or 1.8 to 1 VisWire. And a good antenna tuner will bring that down, and the whole system runs at 98% efficiency. That's the good news. Now comes an antenna that you've thrown together kind of in a hurry, and at the end of the band that you care about, the VisWire goes up to 15 to 1. Your feed line was not really as big as a piece of hard line. It was a piece of RG58. It's got a fair amount of loss, even at 80 meters, because you're running 100 feet of it. And now the high VisWire of the antenna means that even with an antenna tuner in the shack, the signal's going to be bouncing back and forth a whole lot. And you're going to get a fair amount of loss. And maybe you're going to end up at 35% efficiency of transmission because of the loss in your cable. Well, 35% efficiency is something like 5 decibels lower than you would be if you had 100% efficiency. So if you're starting off with enough power, a 300-watt transmitter, maybe even a 100-watt transmitter, and you're getting 35% efficiency, so 35 watts is really being radiated, and you're competing with these QR people that are running 5 watts, you're going to make a lot of QSOs. You're not going to be a big gun. You're not going to be an easy guy that gets through during a pileup when somebody goes to some rare island and everybody's shouting for him. You're not going to easily get through. But at a max, you're going to have some good QSOs. You're on the air. It's not an intolerable situation. So if you've got that piece of RG58 into a 15-to-1 VisWire antenna, and you can either use your in-the-shack antenna tuner or pay a fair amount of dollars to get a remotely tunable antenna tuner that's up at the antenna, and it takes the 15-to-1 VisWire down to 1-to-1, and now your 35% efficiency of antenna transmitting system gets up to 95% efficiency, which makes you 4.5 dB louder, is that worth all the $100 or $300 it's going to take you to do that, as opposed to buying a piece of RG8 cable and buying another, putting up a second dipole, where the second dipole